Junior high honky, junior high honky, junior high honky, my bullies chanted at me. They chanted, you're so ugly, 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 oh, aha, oh, aha, you're ugly. Not all of the Spokane Indian girls called me names. I distinctly remember the kindness of many girls. Those kind girls have grown into kind women. But there were three girls in particular who incessantly bullied me. And they happened to be beautiful and overwhelmingly popular. Shit, one of them owned her own snowmobile and a full-body snowsuit she could have worn to climb Mount Everest. A snowmobile. A fucking snowmobile on the rez. I didn't even have my own radio. I didn't have a bicycle. I had to wear my only pair of shoes, tennis shoes bought in Kmart during winter. But Sherman, my critics like to say, not all Indians are poor on the reservation. So yes, 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 I agree. There were a few rich Indians, relatively speaking, who lived on my reservation. There were also a few middle-class Indians living on my res, and nearly all of those rich and middle-class Indians were dickheads. There was income inequality on my res. There was a 99% and a 1%. There was social and political separation based on economic and cultural class. I can't imagine how those class differences play out now within tribes that have serious casino money. Or maybe I can imagine it. There are plenty of tribes disenrolling their members, legally destroying their tribal identities, exiling them. I think of those wildly successful casino tribes, and I wonder if their reservations have come to resemble and mimic the iniquities of the United States itself. Doesn't an Indian tribe finally surrender to colonization by becoming as capitalistic as our conquerors? Isn't indigenous economic sovereignty one of the sneakiest damn oxymorons of all time? I was a poor res boy, and from the spring of 1978 through the fall of 1979, I was intensely belittled by three Indians who had some family money, whose parents had and kept jobs. My father died at age 64 without ever having had a checking account in his name. So yes, I was a poor kid. And those three rich Indian girls bullied and brainwashed me. They called me ugly, with such cruel and constant precision, that I came to fully believe that I was ugly. I looked in the mirror and said, "You're ugly, ugly, ugly." I often look in the mirror now and say, "You're ugly. Ugly. Ugly." That same fall, during the first few days of seventh grade, I opened my math book and saw my mother's maiden name written on the inside cover. I cursed at the obvious injustice. They had handed me that ancient math book because I was an Indian kid, and because I was a reservation kid, and because I was a small town kid. And because I was a poor reservation Indian from a small town in a small state in a region of the country where almost every kid, no matter their race, is treated like shit by the rich and powerful. I was enraged at the racism and classism. I felt doomed. I felt like all my classmates, my fellow tribal members, were also doomed. In real life, I stood and threw that 30-year-old math book across the room and impaled it 3 inches deep into the wall. In the fictional version of that incident, as detailed in my novel, The Absolutely True Diary of Apartheid Indian, My autobiographical avatar throws that math book across the room and breaks the teacher's nose. The fictional version is much more satisfying. My childhood dream had been to become a pediatrician. Like all of the doctors who had treated me so well during my sickly childhood. But the reservation school was so shitty at that point, so devoid of advanced math and science curricula, that I might as well have been dreaming of becoming bulletproof, invisible, and 10 feet tall. When I got home from school that day, after being suspended for 3 days for throwing that old math book into the wall, I asked my mother and father if I could leave the reservation school and go somewhere different, somewhere better. My father had gone, on purpose, to Immaculate Heart of Mary Academy, a Catholic school in Coeur d'Alene, where he and his sister were the only Indians. So I don't think it was a shocking idea to him that I might want to see more of the world. He'd been in the army. He'd traveled on all-Indian basketball teams through Canada, Montana, the Dakotas, Idaho, Oregon, and Northern California. When he was drunk, he often bragged that he used to have a Japanese girlfriend who lived in San Francisco. He'd written the first 30 pages of an autobiographical novel about his love affair with her. I doubt she was real, but he'd wanted her to be real. My father's lifelong dream had been to live in Phoenix, Arizona. He said, "I want to live in a place where it never gets cold." So, by action and ambition, my father had always been a traveler. But my mother, except for a brief period where she became a teen mother in Sacramento and another where she became a teen bride in Arlee, Montana, had never lived off the reservation. And difficult and terrible things had happened to her when she had traveled away from the res. So, considering their respective histories with adventure, it is not surprising that my father supported my escape. But I remain stunned that my mother gave her consent. I know I was brave to leave the reservation school, but I think my parents were far more courageous in letting me go. I was so young. I was a fucked up Indian boy. And, despite being descended from thousands of years of traditional Native people and their conservative lives, my parents said yes when I asked to be a total radical and leave my tribal school. My mother, despite all the pain she caused me, saved my life twice. The first time, in 1973, she saved my siblings and me when she stopped drinking and made our home a relatively safe, place to live. And then, she saved my life again, when she let me walk away from the Spokane Indian Reservation in 1979, never to fully return. This is a familiar story for those listeners who already know my work. But I have never fully told the truth about all of my reasons for leaving the reservation school for the white high school 22 miles away. So for the first time in public, here's my most honest account for my actions. I left the reservation in the desperate pursuit of a higher and better education, in search of a more epic life. But, with an equal amount of desperation, I also fled the reservation because I believed that no Spokane Indian woman would ever marry me. Because I was too ugly to be loved by any of them. I set sail on an academic adventure, but I was also on a mission to find love. So, after a year-long effort in building courage, I transferred to the farm town junior high in Reardon, where I became Jason, and my ambitions became the Argonauts. I allowed my wife who'd seen me naked and touched me thousands of times, to finally touch me in those places where I had hoarded so much of my pain and shame. While I was working on the early drafts of this chapter, I said to my wife, "You know, I have been thinking about the res, and what would have happened to me if I hadn't left. I have been trying to figure out which Spokane Indian woman I would have married if I'd stayed. And you know, I don't think any of them would have married me. I really don't. And not any women from the other tribes living on our res either." My wife was reluctant to follow that particular line of conversation with me. What person wants to debate the merits, the possibilities of their real spouses, imaginary husbands or wives? At the time, I was miffed that she was unwilling to hear me think out loud about potential lovers and spouses. But shit, I was obsessed with this book and its ideas. Like every other writer, I'd set aside my real-world manners in order to rudely pursue an idea. So I continued to ponder the question by myself. If I'd stayed on the reservation, then who would I have loved? And who would have loved me? Nobody. 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 And then I remembered Angie, the white daughter of a white traveling salesman. Sounds like the beginnings of a dirty joke, right? I met Angie during my tribe's Memorial Day powwow in 1979. I was almost 13, and she was 14. Angie's father owned and operated a mobile arts and crafts and toy shop. That description is way too polite, so let me try again. Angie and her family lived in a rugged RV that also served as the warehouse and storefront for glass jewelry and polyester t-shirts and stuffed animals that resembled no living creature and thin plastic toys that broke within hours and candies that were clumsy-ass rip-offs of famous brands. So yeah, maybe Hershey's chocolate bars were your favorite candy, but that's only because you never had a bag of Hershey's Choco Dust. Angie and her family lived in Seattle or Tacoma, I think. But they spent their summers and school year weekends traveling from powwow to state fair to rodeo to car shows to wherever they could park their RV and sell their cheap goods. In 1979, 20 or 30 of those traveling vendors had set up shop at our powwow grounds. And we Indian kids, the ones who didn't dance powwow, would walk the circle of those vendors like we were cruising in cars. Around and around we'd go, examining and re-examining the cheap merchandise, eating fry bread and cotton candy and snow cones, and staring at all the Indians we knew and all of those Indians who were strangers. And we'd also stare at the white tourists and vendors. It was past 10 p.m. as I walked by Angie and her family's booth for the first time. I stopped and stared. She was a very skinny and pale girl with brown hair. Rather plain, I guess, but a confident and loud salesperson. "What are you staring at?" she asked me. "Your shirt," I said. She looked down as if she'd forgotten what she was wearing. On the front of her shirt, on her flattish chest, was the image of an old radio with two anatomical-looking dials. Below that radio was the printed command, "Don't touch these knobs. They're well-adjusted." Angie laughed at her sexually suggestive shirt, then turned around. On the back of her shirt was the message, "From behind, it's all the same." At that time, I was too young and damaged to understand the explicit pedophilia of that shirt. I was only 12. but there were hundreds of adults who must have seen that young girl wearing that shirt. What did they think when they saw it? T-shirts are $5 each, Angie said, or 3 for $10. I don't have any money, I said. Then why are you here? She asked. I didn't have an answer. Do you like me? She asked. I think I took a step back because she took 2 steps toward me. Come back in an hour, she said. I have my bathroom break. We can walk. In the dark. She was only 14, but she was as brash as her shirt. I was terrified and intrigued. Okay, I said. I didn't have any clue what to do for that next hour, so I reverted to habit and kept walking the circle and walked by Angie 8 or 10 times. I would smile at her. She'd smile at me. I didn't know a thing about romance, so I didn't realize that my aimless circles had become courtship. Finally, after an hour, Angie ran to me, grabbed my hand, and pulled me away into the dark parking lot near the darker and unused rodeo arena. She sat on a truck bumper, and I leaned against a light pole. "What's your name?" she asked. "Junior," I said. "I'm Angie. Some people call me Annie or AJ. My dad says I shouldn't be chasing after Indian boys." She leaned toward me and whispered, "My dad hates Indians." I wasn't surprised by the racism. I've rarely been surprised to encounter racism. "Do you like Indians?" I asked. "I like you," she said. "Do you want to kiss me?" I couldn't talk, but I could move. So I sat on the bumper next to her. I leaned in for the kiss, but she leaned away. I leaned toward her again, and she leaned away again, to and fro, almost a kiss, not a kiss, almost a kiss, not a kiss. I worried that Angie was making fun of me, but then I realized she was having fun. She was enjoying me. I was having fun too, but I was confused and obviously not as experienced as she was. And it troubles me now to think about why she was expertly flirtatious. Then I heard a mocking voice. "Hey, Junior, who's your girlfriend?" It was one of my regular bullies, a muscular Spokane Indian boy who would die young. "Junior," he said again, "who's your girlfriend?" My bully was drunk. His 2 friends, also drunk, laughed. I sensed real danger. "Run," I yelled. So Angie ran. She was the fastest sprinter I had ever seen. She disappeared into the dark before I could take a few steps. I have always been slow, and slow is not a good thing to be when you're a reservation prey animal. My 3 drunk bullies quickly caught me, but they didn't hurt me too badly. They slapped me in the balls a few times, made fun of my speech impediments, and let me go. I thought about looking for Angie, but I was scared my bullies would hunt me down again. So I ran the 2 miles home, crawled into my bed, and did not return to the powwow that year. I skipped the 1980 powwow entirely because I was publicly preparing to leave the res school for the white high school. I allowed my wife, who'd seen me naked and touched me thousands of times, to finally touch me in those places, where I had hoarded so much of my pain and shame. While working on this chapter, I texted my sister. If I stayed on the res, who do you think I would have married? You would have met some girl at an all-Indian basketball tourney, my sister texted back. Probably some urban Indian from Portland or Seattle. You would have married some coastal Salish college girl and moved to the city. You would have got a tattoo of a killer whale. But do you think anybody from our res would have married me? Doesn't matter, my sister texted. You were always going to leave. You were always going to end up urban. In 1981, after my first year among the white folks of Reardon, I returned to our tribe's Memorial Day powwow. I thought I might get bullied, but I'd grown physically and emotionally stronger in a short time. I was no longer an easy mark. I'd become a popular and admired kid in Reardon as a scholar and basketball player, and yes, as a potential boyfriend. The girls in Reardon paid attention to me. They asked me questions. I asked them questions. We listened to each other's answers. I had kissed one girl on a school bus and another in a hayloft. So, at that powwow, my new and overt self-esteem must have shone like knight's armor. One Spokane boy looked at me and said, "Damn, you're growing like a weed." And his friend, another Spokane, said, "His skull is growing even bigger now. It's a fucking planet." I was ready to throw punches, but they kept laughing and walked past. Both of those Indian boys died before they turned 40. I don't remember them with anger. Well, I still feel residual anger. But mostly, I think about how lonely and desperate they must have felt in their short and tragic lives. How much pain had they suffered? How many dark secrets did they have to keep? Why had they always felt the need to pick on me? That was the last time I felt physically threatened by a bully on my reservation. After that, my reservation enemies and detractors would only gossip about me, and rarely in my presence. Alone, I walked the powwow circle of vendors, and then stopped when I saw Angie again. Of course, I remembered the white girl I had almost kissed at the powwow 2 years earlier. I was now almost 15. She was 16. And she was obviously pregnant and ready to give birth at any moment. She was working at an ice cream truck, scooping out freezer-burned chocolate and vanilla. Two flavors is better than one for res kids. Her big belly, the t-shirt stretched taut over her belly, was smeared with ice cream. I was stunned by her pregnancy. I remember thinking, shit, if things had happened differently 2 years earlier, maybe I would have gotten her pregnant. Maybe I would be a teen father. Then I felt irrationally jealous and possessive, as if Angie and I had been seriously involved, as if we had real-world ties to each other. But damn, we'd only held hands. Our brief powwow date had lasted maybe 15 minutes. I didn't know her last name or where she lived. She lived somewhere that wasn't the reservation. That was her full address. Pregnant Angie, not the reservation, USA. I was also scared for her. Even then, I knew that by getting pregnant so young, she had made her life infinitely more difficult. And I kept imagining that other difficult world where I was the father of her child. And then I had to talk to her. I needed to talk to her. So I stood in line and made my slow way toward her. "What flavor you want?" she asked me when it was finally my turn. She didn't recognize me. She barely looked at me. "Chocolate in a plain cone," I said. She must have recognized my voice, my lispy, stammering tenor, because she studied my face. "I know you," she said. I didn't know what to say. I felt suddenly embarrassed and shy. "I know you," she said again. I can't explain why I felt so much shame at that moment. It almost felt like I was the father of her child and I had abandoned her. And I suspect there's something patriarchal and narcissistic about feeling that way, but I can't exactly explain that either. I think perhaps I had never been so clearly reminded of the non-fatal ways in which I could have trapped myself on the rez. "Your name is Junior," Angie said. She didn't smile. She didn't look upset. She had remembered my name, which should have been flattering, I suppose. "You're Junior, right?" Angie asked. At that moment, I thought about who I had become in the 2 years since I had last seen her. "My name isn't Junior," I said. "I'm Sherman." She knew I was lying, but she didn't challenge me. She didn't say anything as I turned and walked away. I allowed my wife, who'd seen me naked and touched me thousands of times, to finally touch me in those places where I had hoarded so much of my pain and shame. A few years ago, I wrote a poem based on my extremely brief relationship with Angie, but I wrote it as if our relationship had been far more substantial, as if she and I had been older and more desperate, as if the worst things I feared about her life and my life had come true. White girl powwow love. She was skinny and buttermilk pale. She wore her hair with a rat tail, and I knew I'd two-step to jail for her love, which was the no-fail pickup line that year. "I'm in jail," I said, "and only you got the bail to rescue me." She smelled like stale everything, and though I was frail, I talked her into chucking the bail and disobeying her dad, a whale who thought everything was for sale, especially the sacred. So we sailed, her and me, on the powwow trail, until my dirty joke splat failed. The porno punchline was snails. White girl angry, she dug her nails into my skin and said, "Why you males have to heave and hove and dog whale such awful shit?" She was a gale, a storm through a trailer park veil, an F5 on the tornado scale. And I wanted to push aside her veil and touch and memorize her pale skin like a blind man touches braille. And so I did. Virgin clumsy, I flailed at her buttons, and that tough rail of a girl went all weakness and quail. I thought I was all res prevail. But then she put on her chainmail armor and golf ball size hailed me with this confessional tale. "My daddy is a goddamn whale killer," she said. "Ain't no scale to weigh his evil. His devil pail is filled to the brim." She wailed tears like anvils and then bailed on me. She ran back down the trail and I ran after her, but I failed to catch her. Her pain felt like nails. And though I never saw her pale self again, I pray without fail, when I think of her stuck in jail. Or maybe, still walking powwow trail. A white girl, skinny, hard, and frail, and likely wed to a killer of whales. After reading an early draft of this chapter, my friend, a white woman, asked me, "Why didn't those Spokane Indian girls like you?" "Most of them liked me," I said, "but only as a goofy geek. I didn't possess any of those qualities deemed sexually attractive to the women of my reservation. I still don't have any of those qualities." "And what were those qualities?" my friend asked. "I didn't dance or sing powwow," I said. "I didn't stick game. I wasn't a church kid. I didn't become a good basketball player until I left the res. I had speech impediments. I was bookish and shy. I cried all the time. I hardly ever left my basement bedroom. I was ugly." "You weren't ugly," my friend said. "I have known you for 30 years, and I have seen the photos of you when you were a kid. You were always cute, and you wore purple striped shirts." Nobody thought I was cute until I left the res. "The Indian ugly duckling syndrome," she said. "That sounds so corny," I said, "but I don't think it's inaccurate. There might be some truth to it." "You're trying to write the truth, aren't you?" my friend asked. "My highly flawed version of the truth," I said. "Then why don't you call up those Indian women you grew up with? Why don't you ask them why they never fell in love with you?" I laughed and laughed. "Oh, God," I said, "that feels like the most dangerous thing I could ever do." "That makes it sound like it's something you need to do," my friend said. "I am married to an amazing Native woman," I said. "I know she loves me." "Is your wife the first Indian woman who ever loved you?" "Yes," I said, and thought about that first moment, whose details I will not share, when I realized that my wife adored me. I remember that her adoration made me tremble. I remember that I felt healed and challenged at the same time. I remember hoping that I would continue to deserve that adoration and that I would always adore her in return. To be so romantically loved by a Native American woman was a revelation. My late father loved my wife. "Is she really as nice as she seems?" he asked me when Diane and I were first dating. "Yes, she is," I said. "My late mother loved my wife, too." "She seems tough enough to deal with you," my mother said when Diane and I were first dating. "Yes, she is," I said. Monosonnet. For the matriarchy, interrupted. When a woman asks you to owl dance, oh, 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 the owl dance, 2 steps forward, 1 step back. Oh, 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 listen to the drummers attack that drum. Oh, 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 if a woman asks you to owl dance, you have to accept her offer. Oh, 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 oh. But if you still have the nerve to decline, then you must pay her what she wants. Oh, 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 oh. Give her some money, honey. Fill her coffers. Oh, 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 oh. And then you have to stand in front of the entire powwow and tell everybody exactly why and how you refused her. Oh, 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 oh. And if you refuse to detail your refusal, you will be named and shamed out of the powwow. Oh, 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 but mister, Why would you want to say no to your sister? Oh, 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 but brother, why would you want to say no to your mother? Oh, 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 all of these women are your sisters and mothers. Oh, 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 there's somebody's sisters and mothers. So mister, so brother, dance with the women. Mister, 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 brother, they're everybody's sisters and mothers. You should always honor the chance. I was joined in my sophomore year at Reardon by my sisters Kim and Arlene, twins who are a year younger. I was also shocked to see one of my childhood bullies from the res. She was one of those beautiful Spokane Indian girls who had called me ugly, who had called me junior high honky. And now, she was standing in the hallway of Reardon. My school. My school. My school. She saw me, smiled, and said, "Hello, Sherman," stretching out my name in a mocking fashion. I'd been known only as Junior on the res, and now she was already giving me shit for my new name, my new identity. My sister saw it happen. "What are you gonna do about her?" she asked me. "She better learn quick," I said. "This is not welping it." I was enormously popular in Reardon, with kids and adults, and I enjoyed the corresponding social power. But I also made a conscious effort to be egalitarian, to be friends with every social group. I was surrounded by kind people, and more than a few small farm town racists, and I was scared my bully would ruin all the good stuff. "If she tries to fuck with me," I said to my sister, "I will crush her. If she leaves me alone, then I will leave her alone." Because my bully was smart, funny, charismatic, and gorgeous, she quickly made friends with a few of her classmates. She was a year younger than me, so we didn't have any classes together. For a few weeks, it seemed like our social lives would be separate. I was on guard, vigilant, ready to defend myself against any social attack she might launch. If we'd been in a bigger school, we probably could have avoided each other. But our high school had one hallway and 10 classrooms, so we were constantly in each other's sightlines. I found myself cast in a weird-ass John Hughes movie where two Indians were the leads. I don't know what my bully was thinking during those few weeks. I imagine she was afraid. I imagine she felt lost. I imagine she felt powerless. She was the new kid, and that's always stressful. And of course, she must have been puzzled by my popularity. How had I, the res peon, become a white high school superstar? How could Junior Alexi, the Omega Dog, now be Sherman Alexi, the young man who was loved and respected? Hell, I started the drama club in that farm town and got 30 people to join. I wonder if she ever considered befriending me. I wonder if I would have accepted and trusted her friendship. Those questions are hypothetical, of course, because my bully could not help herself. She could not be happy in a world where she was not allowed to belittle me. So one morning, as I walked past her in the hallway, as she huddled with a group of her new friends, she turned my name into an insult. "Hey, Sperman! Hey, Sperman!" She laughed. I stopped and stared at her. She smiled at me, as if she had won something. In Wolpenit, that behavior would have been acceptable. In Reardon, it was not. My sister told me later that she'd seen all of that happen. "She did that to you," my sister said, "and I knew it was over for her." Over the next few hours, I whispered a few things to a few friends. Those whispered things were whispered to others, and those whispers continued to be whispered. Within a few days, my sister ran up to me in the hallway and told me she had just seen my bully eating all by herself at a big table in the lunchroom. "She looks so sad," my sister said. A few days after that, my bully had transferred back to the school on the reservation. It was a decisive victory. I had saved myself. Do I feel good about how I exiled my bully? Yes, I feel great. Do I also feel bad about how I exiled my bully? More than 3 decades later, I still feel guilty. But I know it was necessary. I know it was self-defense. I know it was justifiable. But it also revealed to me how willing I was to socially torture another person. You can call me vindictive, and I will not disagree. I allowed my wife, who'd seen me naked and touched me thousands of times, to finally touch me in those places where I had hoarded so much of my pain and shame. I called my sister and asked her what else she remembered about my battle with my bully. "I want to know if you remember something I don't," I said. "She was mad at me for years," my sister said, "and I had nothing to do with it. I was an innocent bystander." "You've never been innocent." My sister laughed, but she was laughing too hard for that small joke. What? I asked. "I bet if you stayed on the res, you would have married her." "Fuck that," I said, and laughed. "But it's not an inconceivable thought. My bully ended up leaving the res school again and graduated from a different but mostly white high school. She graduated from college. She's always been ambitious, talented, and highly opinionated. She hasn't lived on the reservation for years, but remains connected through family, friends, culture, and business. She also has plenty of enemies on the res. My bully and I are the same kind of Spokane Indians." I am laughing as I write this because I realize now, after all of these years, that my bully had followed me to Reardon. She had attempted to use my escape route. She had emulated me. I laugh even harder because I am quite sure she would absolutely deny that. And now I am laughing at the thought that maybe she and I would have gone to the prom together, or heck, since it was a farm town, maybe she and I would have gone to the harvest ball. Two Spokane Indians slow dancing while surrounded by white kids and hay bales festooned with blue ribbons, while Hank Williams Jr. or Spandau Ballet played a love ballad. That's the happy ending of the John Hughes movie about Indians, ain't it? I allowed my wife, who'd seen me naked and touched me thousands of times, to finally touch me in those places where I had hoarded so much of my pain and shame. But I have to keep asking. If I had stayed on the reservation, then whom do I think I would have married? I bet I would have fallen in love with a white school teacher, one of those crusading liberals who come to the res hoping to save Indians. Most of those teachers last for only a year or two. Saving Indians is a tough job with long hours and terrible pay. But some of those white teachers stay for their entire lives. During my travels to many reservations over the last 25 years, I have met a few white teachers who fell in love with and married Indian people. I once met a TV news reporter, a white woman who fell in love with an Indian man as she was interviewing him. On the res, we were standing in a wild grass field overlooking the river valley, the woman said to me. I was filing a report about environmental efforts on the reservation, and I just kept being distracted by the beauty of the landscape. And I looked at this Indian man, and he was so beautiful too. And he and that landscape belong together, you know. And I thought, hey, I want some of that action. And I have been getting that action for 20 years. During high school and college, I fell deeply in love with two women, both white. Marriage was discussed. They both broke up with me. And shortly after breaking up with me, they each met the white man they would marry. They are both still married. I have always wished them well. I remember them with affection and respect. I suppose, in many ways, one never stops loving the people they loved during their youth, or hating the people they hated. My bully re-entered my life in 2005 or 2006, maybe it was 2007 or 2003. I was giving a reading at Auntie's Bookstore in Spokane. As always, I had reserved a section of seats for my mother, siblings, cousins, nieces, and nephews. My siblings and mother took their seats early in the bookstore. But I was still in my hotel room getting ready. So my sister had to tell me what happened before I arrived. So we're sitting there, my sister said, and she, the bully, and two other Spokane Indian women, who had never liked me either, come striding in and just took seats in the reserve section. Maybe they thought the reserved section was reserved for reservation Indians who had made a reservation, I said. Oh, my sister said, that's a dumb joke. Anyways, they sat in our section and wouldn't even look at us. They looked all mad in the face. I immediately noticed my bully when I walked into the bookstore. I don't even remember the two other Spokane Indian women who'd accompanied her. It was only the second time I'd seen her since I'd exiled her from Reardon more than 20 years earlier. I'd first seen her in the reservation trading post during the summer after I'd exiled her. I spotted her and tried to dodge behind a shelf, but she saw me and rushed at me, cursing. I don't remember exactly what she said, but she was furious at me. She knew that I had exiled her. She hated me for it. I was sheepish, defiant, amused, and angry. I don't remember what I said. I wish I would have said, "I see that I hurt you. Do you have any idea how much you've hurt me over the years?" But I imagine I instead offered her an empty apology, and I assume she rejected it. So now, more than a decade after that encounter, my bully was sitting in the front row at my reading. I wasn't even remotely the Indian boy she knew in Reardon or Wellpinit. I had become the kind of Indian man who can talk glorious shit to talk show hosts and U.S. presidents on national television. But damn it, my bully still made me nervous. She was still smart and beautiful. She was still intimidating. I heard "Junior High Honky" echoing inside my always fragile head. I performed my poems and stories. I improvised stories and jokes. I interacted with the audience. And I watched my bully take notes the entire time. Battle plans, I assumed. And I thought, holy shit, she is going to verbally challenge me in front of 400 of my most ardent fans, in front of my hometown crowd. Is she really this brave and stupid? Doesn't she know how good I am on stage? Can't she see how I would win any war of insults against her? I have to admit that I was absolutely overjoyed at the thought of the impending confrontation. And then I looked at my mother, at my sisters, at my nieces, at my female cousins. I looked at those Spokane Indians, those Native American women, and I thought about how much sorrow and pain they'd endured in their lives. How Native women everywhere are so targeted for violence by tribal and American society. I love those Native women I call my family and friends. But I don't love my bully, not even a little bit. However, I realized that I had no need to win some imaginary fight with her. I had no desire to hurt her feelings. I didn't want to walk the circle of animosity anymore. I wasn't going to forgive her. I'm not a sap. She would have to actually apologize in order for me to think about forgiving her. But stop, stop, stop. I wanted that shit to stop. So when she raised her hand, I politely called on her 3 separate times and answered questions about tribal responsibility, alcoholism, and negative stereotypes of Native Americans. I declared a truce with her, at least within myself. Or maybe it's only a partial truce, because a half-truce is really just a surrender, right? In any case, I hope there is a future powwow where she, an elderly Spokane Indian woman, asks me, an elderly Spokane Indian man, for an owl dance. Yes, of course, I will say. It won't be romantic. It won't be all that friendly. But it will be a clumsy acknowledgement of our lifelong bond, however frayed. On a Saturday morning, in a hotel room in Bellingham, in an Oxford Suites that had 3-dimensional art in the bathroom that spelled WASH in huge wooden capital letters, I said to my wife, I am going to get naked and lie face down on the bed, and I want you to look at my back. I want you to study my back. I want you to study my scars. I want you to tell me what they look like. I want you to touch the scars. I want you to trace their outlines with your fingertips. I want to feel you feeling my scars. Diane did as she was asked. She touched the small scars, ran her fingertips along the longer scars. What do they look like? I asked. They're lighter than they used to be. Huh, I said. Take some pictures with your phone and email them to me. I will look at them later. I thought it might take me weeks to look at the photos of my scarred back. Maybe months. Maybe I would never look at them. So I was surprised to find myself downloading those photos onto my iPad only an hour later. Diane was driving us home to Seattle. She almost always wants to drive, and I almost always want to sit in the passenger seat and daydream. Okay, I said. I am looking at them now. I laughed at how pale my back had become. I've lived in sunless Seattle for 2 decades. I'm an introverted writer who'd rather be inside reading or writing, and I haven't played outdoor shirts and skins pickup basketball in a long time. Looking at my pale back, I realized that it had been at least 15 years since I had been topless in direct sunlight. So my skin had grown pale, had grown from brown to slightly tan. But my acne scars had also grown pale. My skin and my scars were now almost the same color. You can't really see my scars all that much anymore, I said. Only if you look really close, Diane said. Only if you're looking for them. I don't look burned anymore, I said. You're kind of mottled, Diane said, like a feather. My wife and I traveled toward our home, toward our waiting sons. I closed my eyes and dreamed that I was entirely made of feathers. I dreamed I could hover like one feather, like a man made of feathers. And then I dreamed that each of my scars was a bird. And then I flew. Chapter 160, Flight Hours. That bird, small and brown, wrecked against our kitchen window and crashed dead to our deck. Avian suicide, I said, and walked out to retrieve its broken, feathered body. And then I thought of my mother's coffin being carried to the grave by her pallbearers, and realized that I would be the bird's pallbearer. And that realization made me feel responsible for the bird, as if its death needed to matter. As if it weren't just one more member of an essentially endless species. So I sat beside that dead bird and improvised hummed an honor song. And startled, when that bird lifted its head as if my song were a gift that brought it back to life. Of course, I did not resurrect that bird. It had knocked itself out against our window and was now regaining consciousness, but had it broken something, maybe a wing, would it be able to fly? Perhaps I'd have to watch it simply and slowly die. And I knew that I shouldn't let the bird suffer. But I didn't know if I could pick it up and snap its neck. And as I imagined it struggling against my fingers, I knew I wasn't cruel enough to smother it. So what to do? How long would it take to die? Minutes or hours? A day? And what would happen to the defenseless bird if I left it alone on our deck? It would be easy prey for all of the neighborhood predators, insects, rodents, other birds, and all of the mass-murdering house cats. I couldn't stand the thought of this poor bird being eaten alive while it was potentially paralyzed. So yes, I was a weak-ass moralist, unable to kill the bird, and unsure if I had the patience to stand guard as it died. Then, as I pondered, the bird lifted a wing. Ah, such a brave bird.